on the show today, the U.S. government is open, but the fight is just beginning.
If he's upset because he tried to push us in a shutdown and I made sure government didn't shut down, then let's have that fight.
Plus, election results from Slovakia.
Three-time former Prime Minister Fico's Smer SSD party won almost 23% of the vote, more than any other party, after campaigning on a mandate to end military aid to Ukraine.
And later, a suicide attack in Turkey, a Nigerian journalist chasing a very big story, and we look at writing the old-fashioned way, with a fountain pen. Today is Monday, October 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. The latest on a suicide attack in Ankara coming up shortly. Now, though, we look to Washington, where, despite the fact that a U.S. government shutdown has been averted, another week of turmoil seems to be in the making on Capitol Hill. A conservative legislator has promised to be relentless in his efforts to remove Republican Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy from his post. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the latest.
The short-term funding bill that Congress passed Saturday and was signed by President Joe Biden will keep the U.S. government running until at least mid-November. But Biden warned Sunday against a repeat of the chaotic process that preceded the 11th-hour adoption of the stopgap bill.
The brinkmanship has to end, and there shouldn't be another crisis. There's no excuse for another crisis. Consequently, I strongly urge my Republican friends in Congress not to wait. Don't waste time as you did all summer. Pass a year-long budget agreement. Honor the deal we made a few months ago.
But a new showdown might be on the horizon on Capitol Hill. Far-right conservatives aren't happy that House Speaker Kevin McCarthy reached out to Democrats to pass the temporary funding bill. Ousting him is now a top priority for conservative Republican Representative Matt Gaetz.
In January, to get the speakership, Kevin had to agree to certain guardrails on spending. America's lawmakers take one up or down vote on the funding of the entire government. That is crazy. That is the reason we're $33 trillion in debt. We want to move to single subject spending bills. He made that commitment. He broke it.
McCarthy's response was defiant. He appeared on CBS's Face the Nation.
So be it. Bring it on. Let's get over with it and let's start governing. If he's upset because he tried to push us in a shutdown and I made sure government didn't shut down, then let's have that fight.
Regardless of how that plays out, bipartisan compromises will continue to provide a path forward, said Rachel Snyderman with the Bipartisan Policy Center.
There is bipartisan compromise to support additional funding for Ukraine, to support our troops, and ensure that our border security is well funded. And so I think that we're going to see, you know, action on those particular priorities in the coming weeks.
Ukraine and the rest of the world will be watching closely, pointed out political scientist Oscar Pocasangre.
I think longer term, we do need to focus more on a structural reform to institutions and find ways of having more political parties in Congress that would help us reach more consensus in the legislative body, as opposed to just having a back and forth between these two very polarized parties.
Pocasangre noted as well that more political instability could hurt the United States' credibility as well as its economic standing. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
The stopgap funding bill kept the government operating, but it did not include more aid for Ukraine. Funding that was already pledged to Kyiv is not affected by this bill and will continue, but a clearly agitated President Joe Biden spoke with reporters at the White House on Sunday as he tried to reassure Kyiv and other allies that the United States will not abandon Ukraine.
Although the Speaker and overwhelming majority of the Congress have steadfastly supported Ukraine to defend itself against the aggression and brutality of the Russians' attack on women and children, in addition to the military in Ukraine, there's no Ukraine funding in this agreement. Despite that, I did not believe we could let millions of Americans go through the pain of a government shutdown. But let's be clear. I hope my friends on the other side keep their word about support for Ukraine. They said they're going to support Ukraine in a separate vote. We cannot, under any circumstance, allow American support for Ukraine to be interrupted. I fully expect the Speaker to keep his commitment to secure the passage and support needed to help Ukraine as they defend themselves against aggression and brutality.
He was asked by a reporter about his confidence of being able to provide funding for more aid.
Mr. President, what are your words to U.S. allies and in particular Zelensky on continued funding for Ukraine? How can you reassure them?
I can reassure them. Look at me. We're going to get it done. I can't believe those who have voted for supporting Ukraine, overwhelming majority in the House and Senate, Democrat and Republican, will for pure political reasons let more people die needlessly in Ukraine.
Ukraine relies heavily on American and Western support in its fight against Russia's invasion. The PKK, or Kurdistan Workers' Party, has claimed responsibility for a suicide attack on Sunday in Ankara, the Turkish capital. The attack came just hours before the parliament was scheduled to reopen after a recess. The Turkish president describes the attack as a failure. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Cell phone video captures the moment assailants detonate a bomb at a security checkpoint near Turkey's Interior Affairs Ministry in the capital city, Ankara. The Interior Ministry's office labeled the blast as a terrorist attack that happened just hours before Parliament was to reconvene. Turkish Interior Minister Ali Yerlikaya explains what happened at a news conference as provided by Reuters.
One of the terrorists who had a suicide bomb contraption blew himself up. The other was shot in the head and neutralized before he found a chance to blow himself up.
The Interior Minister added that he intends to visit two officers injured in the attack, saying neither was in critical condition. Hours after the blast, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan arrived to address Parliament. He praised the swift action by law enforcement for stopping the attackers. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan speaking Sunday on a Turkish presidential office handout as provided by the Associated Press.
Bu sabah emniyet birimlerimizin...
The action in which two murderers were neutralized is the last stand of terrorism. The scoundrels who targeted the peace and security of the citizens could not achieve their goals. They will never reach them.
A senior Turkish official tells the Reuters news agency the attackers hijacked a vehicle, killing its driver about 260 kilometers southeast of the capital. The bombing was the first in Ankara since 2016. Then, groups such as Islamic State and PKK militants, both labeled as terrorist organizations by the U.S., either claimed or were blamed for attacks on major cities. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
In a related story, the Turkish Defense Ministry says its warplanes have carried out raids on Sunday on suspected Kurdish rebel targets in northern Iraq following the suicide attack in Ankara. A ministry statement said about 20 targets, including caves, shelters, and depots, were destroyed in the aerial operation. And here are more stories we're following from around the world. Egyptian authorities' use of torture amounts to a crime against humanity, rights groups said on Monday in an appeal to the UN to review Egypt's human rights record. The report, submitted to the UN Committee Against Torture, tracked the use of methods including beatings, electrical shocks, sexual violence, and denial of access to medical care by members of the security services. The European Union Parliament backs naming a UN envoy to restart peace talks for the ethnically divided island of Cyprus. Roberto Metsola, president of the EU Parliament, said that Europe would never be complete as long as Cyprus remains divided. 7 months after former President Jimmy Carter entered end-of-life hospice care, he celebrated his 99th birthday on Sunday. It's a milestone few thought the longest-living president might reach. Carter was president from 1977 to 1981. Slovakia's Robert Fico, who won an election after pledging to end military aid to Ukraine, was in pole position to start talks on forming a government on Sunday, while a liberal rival vowed to seek partners to prevent the former leftist prime minister's return to power. Rachel Graham of Reuters has that story.
Three-time former Prime Minister Fico's Smer SSD party won almost 23% of the vote, more than any other party, after campaigning on a mandate to end military aid to Ukraine. A government led by Fico would see NATO member Slovakia joining Hungary in challenging the European Union's consensus on support for Ukraine. It would also signal a further shift in the region against political liberalism, which will once again be tested when Poland goes to the polls later this month. Though touted to win by the exit polls, Liberal Party Progressive Slovakia, or PS, took second place. Its leader, Michala Šimečka, vowed to seek partners to prevent the former leftist prime minister's return to power.
Realistically, there are two options at the table. One is a government led by Mr. Fico, and the other one is a coalition made up of Progressive Slovakia and other partners, which would in fact have over 80 MPs. But we fully respect the fact that the president, as she has said before, is likely to nominate Mr. Fico to give it a try first.
Fico's party is more nationalist and socially conservative, criticizing social liberalism, which it says is imported from Brussels. The PS is liberal on green policies, LGBT rights, deeper European integration, and human rights. Five other parties won seats. Third-placed leftist party Hlas is an offshoot of Fico's Smer party and may be poised to become the kingmaker of a coalition.
That's Reuters' Rachel Graham reporting. From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish, a Nigerian journalist with a very challenging story coming up. And speaking of writing, we take a look at a resurgence of doing it the old-fashioned way. Now, though, the border of Serbia and Kosovo is again the scene of tension and anxiety. The AP's Mimi Montgomery has more.
Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić is rejecting U.S. and EU reports of a military buildup along the country's border with Kosovo. In the wake of rising tension in the Balkan region after a recent deadly shootout, Vučić says reports of increased military presence are untrue, complaining of a campaign of lies against his country. Kosovo's government says it's monitoring Serbian military presence from three different directions and is urging its neighbor to pull back troops and demilitarize the border area. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
For years, Nigerian journalist Philip Obijai has investigated the actions of Russian mercenary group Wagner in Africa. It's a beat that comes with its challenges. VOA News reporter Christina Casiendo-Smith has the story.
As an investigative journalist in Nigeria, Philip Obaji Jr. has covered a lot over the years, including extremist groups, human trafficking, and abuse of civil liberties. But one story really captured the attention of this reporter for the Daily Beast, Russia's Wagner Group in West Africa.
And even with the death of its founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin, there's still so much around this group that we haven't spoken about that we need to tell the world about.
Obaji will continue his reporting on the mercenary organization through a Jim Hogue Reporting Fellowship, awarded by the International Center for Journalists, or ICFJ. The ICFJ honored Obaji and other journalists in Washington late September.
So these journalists have different approaches to telling really interesting stories, often about communities that are undercovered in the regular media.
Obaji's interest in Wagner Group started in 2018. When three Russian journalists were killed on a remote road in the Central African Republic. The trio was investigating the activities of Russian military contractors in the area.
And I wanted to really know exactly what this group was doing in that country, and so that's why I picked up interest. And each time I ask questions, there's always another question to ask, because I get answers that really leaves gaps in between.
But covering such a story has its risks.
I mean, three Russian journalists went to investigate and then they got killed. Local journalists will try to investigate or ask questions about the Wagner Group, either get disappeared or somehow targeted by whether it's Wagner or government forces.
The nonprofit press freedom organization Reporters Without Borders describes the Central African Republic as a dangerous place where journalists are often the targets of threats and violence and subject to pressure from both armed groups and authorities.
That coverage is hardly there in the country because of fear. Yeah, so, but there are brave local journalists who try to work, anonymously with the foreign media to help these stories get up.
With many journalists fearful of covering sensitive issues and sources scared to go on record, reporting on groups like Wagner, it's tough. So, fellowships, like the one Obagi received, can help reporters cover difficult stories and reach wider audiences.
It is a really interconnected and global society, and what happens in Africa or what happens in South America have ramifications on how we choose to act and what we choose to support and how we want to move forward as a global community.
After his brief visit to Washington, Obagi returns to Nigeria to continue his work on a long-form project focused on the Wagner Group. Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News, Washington.
More than a dozen people have been killed in a fire in adjoining nightclubs in Spain. Lauren Anthony of Reuters has the story.
More than a dozen people have been killed after a fire tore through adjoining nightclubs in the Spanish city of Murcia, emergency services said on Sunday. They added that rescuers were still searching for those unaccounted for after the blaze. Footage released by Murcia's fire service showed firefighters working to control the flames. Outside the club, shocked young people hugged as they waited for information. This witness said he left moments before the alarms went off and all the lights went out. Some of his family and friends are still missing. The fire broke out in the early hours in Atalayas, on the outskirts of the city. Diego Serral of Spain's National Police told reporters the dead were found in the La Fonda nightclub, which has sustained the majority of fire damage, including the collapse of its roof. A spokesperson for the Teatro nightclub told reporters the fire originated in La Fonda before spreading to the other two adjoining clubs. The cause of the blaze is being investigated. Spanish media reported several birthday celebrations were taking place at the time.
That's Lauren Anthony of Reuters reporting. And finally, today, the fountain pen is a writing instrument declared obsolete numerous times by technological innovation. The ballpoint pen, the typewriter, then the computer, and now rendering our voices into text messages on cell phones. But the 19th century invention is still in demand and is itself evolving, thanks to a young American mechanical engineer. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman has the story from Philadelphia.
In a warehouse in a gritty Philadelphia neighborhood, Ian Shawn is doing something no one else in America does: manufacturing writing implements with nibs, the business end of the pen, handcrafted from titanium.
The way we're doing it is really what makes us separate from the other brands and other companies that have done this in the past, which is utilizing equipment in this workshop that's traditionally designed for aerospace or medical manufacturing and repurposing it to create an innovative, unique experience that is just different.
Not only different in the 21st century, it's also counterintuitive. With a risky investment and expensive equipment to make a product for a niche market.
A fountain pen's impractical. It can be messy. It's not as good as a ballpoint pen. It's expensive. So it's really in line with the culture of the pen user that it's irrational and strange.
Showing off his collection at Philadelphia's 130-year-old Pen and Pencil Club, formed by journalists fielding fountain pens to conduct their interviews, investment analyst Tony Blair says the antiquated writing instrument endures as an antidote to the digital age.
Anytime you introduce input-output, like you do with a computer, now there's also, well, there's these other distractions, and if I get a pop-up and lose my thread, or if I type up something, am I going to remember it to the same way that I think writing something by hand helps you remember it?
For many of the younger generations who did not get instruction in cursive script, this instrument is as mysterious as the rotary dialed telephone or the film camera.
Now we have a really cool collection that I would say is great for novice users in particular.
That's Liz Sieber, owner of Philadelphia's Omoizaka Japanese themed stationery shop, which sells fountain pens, writing paper, and ink.
some people really understand what the different nibs are about and the difference between a machine-aligned or a hand-aligned nib. And then we also meet a lot of people who have never tried one before and are looking for something that's like not too expensive, easy to use, plays nice with a lot of different types of paper.
More stores in Japan than in the United States carry Sean's Made in Philadelphia pens, thus creating a tiny entry on the export side of America's trade deficit ledger.
I love that challenge. I love being the underdog. And I like just also, you know, defying the things we think about when it comes to the way we run a business, you know, are very in line with the reasons people use fountain pens.
That challenge is also writing a new page in the story of American entrepreneurship. Steve Herman, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow voanews.com on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Our increasingly interconnected world may be a boon for business and tourism, but it presents an increasing threat to global health. Today, pathogens such as the COVID-19 virus can migrate across the globe at the speed of a passenger airplane. The devastating impacts of COVID-19 demonstrated why the world needs a more collaborative, cohesive, and equitable approach to preventing, preparing for, and responding to pandemics, said World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. That is why global leaders decided in a high-level United Nations meeting to make the world better prepared for future pandemics by strengthening international cooperation, coordination, governance, and the investment necessary to avert or minimize a future peril. Recognizing the need to be prepared for possible emerging threats, the United States joined the other countries, pledging to improve pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, the United States worked with partners around the world to deliver vaccines, tests, treatments, and supplies, and to invest in regional and local efforts to stop the disease. In collaboration with COVAX and other partners, we donated over 688 million safe and effective vaccines to 117 countries and economies around the world. Building on our long-standing commitment to strengthen global health security, we are preparing to meet the next health emergency in four key ways. First, we will collaborate with countries around the world to improve disease detection capabilities, to strengthen laboratory systems and train health workers, and improve biosafety. Second, we will engage with the private sector to develop a system that will make it easier for countries around the world to access vaccines, tests, treatments, and other supplies when they most need them. Third, to help countries finance vital countermeasures during future health emergencies, we will boost multilateral efforts like the Pandemic Fund. So far, the United States has supported this fund with $450 million and plans to contribute another $250 million. Finally, to improve the speed, coordination, and transparency of global response to the next health security threat, we are working with numerous partners to modernize existing organizations, like the World Health Organization. Nation. United Nation member states demonstrated their collective commitment to pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response so that people everywhere can forge a safer, more secure future. The United States is committed to doing its part.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.